Books on Tape presents The Lost World by Michael Crichton, read by Scott Brick. What really interests me is whether God had any choice in the creation of the world. Albert Einstein. Deep in the chaotic regime, slight changes in structure almost always cause vast changes in behavior. Complex, controllable behavior seems precluded. Stuart Kaufman. Sequelae are inherently unpredictable. Ian Malcolm. Introduction. Extinction at the KT boundary. The late 20th century has witnessed a remarkable growth in scientific interest in the subject of extinction. It is hardly a new subject. Baron Georges Cuvier had first demonstrated that species became extinct back in 1786, not long after the American Revolution. Thus, the fact of extinction had been accepted by scientists for nearly three quarters of a century before Darwin put forth his theory of evolution. And after Darwin, the many controversies that swirled around his theory did not often concern issues of extinction. On the contrary, extinction was generally considered as unremarkable as a car running out of gas. Extinction was simply proof of failure to adapt. How species adapted was intensely studied and fiercely debated. But the fact that some species failed was hardly given a second thought. What was there to say about it? However, beginning in the 1970s, two developments began to focus attention on extinction in a new way. The first was the recognition that human beings were now very numerous and were altering the planet at a very rapid rate, eliminating traditional habitats, clearing the rainforest, polluting air and water, perhaps even changing global climate. In the process, many animal species were becoming extinct. Some scientists cried out in alarm. Others were quietly uneasy. How fragile was the Earth's ecosystem? Was the human species engaged in behavior that would eventually lead to its own extinction? No one was sure. Since nobody had ever bothered to study extinction in an organized way, there was little information about rates of extinction in other geological eras. So scientists began to look closely at extinction in the past, hoping to answer anxieties about the present. The second development concerned new knowledge about the death of the dinosaurs. It had long been known that all dinosaur species had become extinct in a relatively short time at the end of the Cretaceous era, approximately 65 million years ago. Exactly how quickly those extinctions occurred was a subject of long-standing debate. Some paleontologists believed they had been catastrophically swift. Others felt the dinosaurs had died out more gradually, over a period of 10,000 to 10 million years. Hardly a rapid event. Then, in 1980, physicist Luis Alvarez and three co-workers discovered high concentrations of the element iridium in rocks from the end of the Cretaceous and the start of the Tertiary, the so-called KT boundary. The Cretaceous was shorthanded as K to avoid confusion with the Cambrian and other geological periods. Iridium is rare on Earth, but abundant in meteors. Alvarez's team argued that the presence of so much iridium in rocks at the KT boundary suggested that a giant meteorite, many miles in diameter, had collided with the Earth at that time. They theorized that the resulting dust and debris had darkened the skies, inhibited photosynthesis, killed plants and animals, and ended the reign of the dinosaurs. This dramatic theory captured the media and public imagination. It began a controversy which continued for many years. Where was the crater from this meteor? Various candidates were proposed. There were five major periods of extinction in the past. Had meteors caused them all? Was there a 26-million-year cycle of catastrophe? Was the planet even now awaiting another devastating impact? After more than a decade, these questions remained unanswered. The debate raged on, until August 1993, when at a weekly seminar of the Santa Fe Institute, an iconoclastic mathematician named Ian Malcolm announced that none of these questions mattered, and that the debate over a meteoric impact was a frivolous and irrelevant speculation. "Consider the numbers," Malcolm said, leaning on the podium, staring forward at his audience. "On our planet, there are currently 50 million species of plants and animals. We think that is a remarkable diversity, yet it is nothing compared to what has existed before. We estimate that there have been 50 billion species on this planet since life began. That means that for every 1,000 species that ever existed on the planet, only one remains today. Thus, 99.9% of all species that ever lived are extinct. And mass killings account for only 5% of that total. The overwhelming majority of species died one at a time." The truth, Malcolm said, was that life on Earth was marked by a continuous, steady rate of extinction. By and large, the average lifespan of a species was 4 million years. For mammals, it was 1 million years. Then, the species vanished. So the real pattern was one of species rising, flourishing, and dying out in a few 1 million years. On average, one species a day had become extinct throughout the history of life on the Earth. "But why?" he asked. "What leads to the rise and decline of Earth's species in a 4 million year life cycle?" "One answer is that we do not recognize how continuously active our planet is. Just in the last 50,000 years, a geological blink of an eye, the rainforests have severely contracted, then expanded again. Rainforests aren't an ageless feature of the planet. They're actually rather new. As recently as 10,000 years ago, when there were human hunters on the American continent, an ice pack extended as far down as New York City. Many animals became extinct during that time. So most of Earth's history shows animals living and dying against a very active background. That probably explains 90% of extinctions. If the seas dry up or become more salty, then of course ocean plankton will all die. But complex animals like dinosaurs are another matter, because complex animals have insulated themselves, literally and figuratively, against such changes. Why do complex animals die out? Why don't they adjust? Physically, they seem to have the capacity to survive. There appears to be no reason why they should die. And yet, they do. What I wish to propose is that complex animals become extinct not because of a change in their physical adaptation to their environment, but because of their behavior. I would suggest that the latest thinking in chaos theory, or nonlinear dynamics, provides tantalizing hints to how this happens. It suggests to us that behavior of complex animals can change very rapidly, and not always for the better. It suggests that behavior can cease to be responsive to the environment and lead to decline and death. It suggests that animals may stop adapting. Is this what happened to the dinosaurs? Is this the true cause of their disappearance? We may never know. But it is no accident that human beings are so interested in dinosaur extinction. The decline of the dinosaurs allowed mammals, including us, to flourish. And that leads us to wonder whether the disappearance of the dinosaurs is going to be repeated, sooner or later, by us as well. Whether at the deepest level the fault lies not in blind fate, in some fiery meteor from the skies, but in our own behavior. At the moment, we have no answer. And then he smiled. "But I have a few suggestions," he said. Prologue: Life at the Edge of Chaos. The Santa Fe Institute was housed in a series of buildings on Canyon Road, which had formerly been a convent, and the Institute's seminars were held in a room which had served as a chapel. Now, Standing at the podium with a shaft of sunlight shining down on him, Ian Malcolm paused dramatically before continuing his lecture. Malcolm was 40 years old and a familiar figure at the Institute. He had been one of the early pioneers in chaos theory, but his promising career had been disrupted by a severe injury during a trip to Costa Rica. Malcolm had, in fact, been reported dead in several newscasts. "I was sorry to cut short the celebrations in mathematics departments around the country," he later said, "but it turned out I was only slightly dead. The surgeons have done wonders, as they will be the first to tell you. So now I am back. In my next iteration, you might say." Dressed entirely in black, leaning on a cane, Malcolm gave the impression of severity. He was known within the Institute for his unconventional analysis and his tendency to pessimism. His talk that August, entitled "Life at the Edge of Chaos," was typical of his thinking. In it, Malcolm presented his analysis of chaos theory as it applied to evolution. He could not have wished for a more knowledgeable audience. The Santa Fe Institute had been formed in the mid-1980s by a group of scientists interested in the implications of chaos theory. The scientists came from many fields: physics, economics, biology, computer science. What they had in common was a belief that the complexity of the world concealed an underlying order which had previously eluded science, and which would be revealed by chaos theory, now known as complexity theory. In the words of one, complexity theory was the science of the 21st century. The Institute had explored the behavior of a great variety of complex systems: corporations in the marketplace, neurons in the human brain, enzyme cascades within a single cell, the group behavior of migratory birds. Systems so complex that it had not been possible to study them before the advent of the computer. The research was new, and the findings were surprising. It did not take long before the scientists began to notice that complex systems showed certain common behaviors. They started to think of these behaviors as characteristic of all complex systems. They realized that these behaviors could not be explained by analyzing the components of the systems. The time-honored scientific approach of reductionism, taking the watch apart to see how it worked, didn't get you anywhere with complex systems, because the interesting behavior seemed to arise from the spontaneous interaction of the components. The behavior wasn't planned or directed. It just happened. Such behavior was therefore called self-organizing. "Of the self-organizing behaviors," Ian Malcolm said, "two are of particular interest to the study of evolution. One is adaptation. We see it everywhere. Corporations adapt to the marketplace. Brain cells adapt to signal traffic. The immune system adapts to infection. Animals adapt to their food supply. We have come to think that the ability to adapt is characteristic of complex systems, and may be one reason why evolution seems to lead toward more complex organisms." He shifted at the podium, transferring his weight onto his cane. "But even more important," he said, "is the way complex systems seem to strike a balance between the need for order and the imperative to change. Complex systems tend to locate themselves at a place we call the edge of chaos. We imagine the edge of chaos as a place where there is enough innovation to keep a living system vibrant and enough stability to keep it from collapsing into anarchy. It is a zone of conflict and upheaval, where the old and the new are constantly at war. Finding the balance point must be a delicate matter. If a living system drifts too close, it risks falling over into incoherence and dissolution. But if the system moves too far away from the edge, it becomes rigid, frozen, totalitarian. Both conditions lead to extinction. Too much change is as destructive as too little. Only at the edge of chaos can complex systems flourish." He paused. "And, by implication, extinction is the inevitable result of one or the other strategy. Too much change or too little. In the audience, heads were nodding. This was familiar thinking to most of the researchers present. Indeed, the concept of the edge of chaos was very nearly dogma at the Santa Fe Institute. Unfortunately, Malcolm continued, the gap between this theoretical construct and the fact of extinction is vast. We have no way to know if our thinking is correct. The fossil record can tell us that an animal became extinct at a certain time, but not why. Computer simulations are of limited value, nor can we perform experiments on living organisms. Thus, we are obliged to admit that extinction, untestable, unsuited for experiment, may not be a scientific subject at all. And this may explain why the subject has been embroiled in the most intense religious and political controversy. I would remind you that there is no religious debate about Avogadro's number, or Planck's constant, or the functions of the pancreas. But about extinction, there has been perpetual controversy for 200 years. And I wonder how it is to be solved if... Yes, what is it? At the back of the room, a hand had gone up, waving impatiently. Malcolm frowned, visibly annoyed. The tradition at the Institute was that questions were held until the presentation ended. It was poor form to interrupt a speaker. You had a question? Malcolm asked. From the back of the room, a young man in his early 30s stood. Actually, the man said, an observation. The speaker was dark and thin, dressed in khaki shirt and shorts, precise in his movements and manner. Malcolm recognized him as a paleontologist from Berkeley named Levine, who was spending the summer at the Institute. Malcolm had never spoken to him, but he knew his reputation. Levine was generally agreed to be the best paleobiologist of his generation, perhaps the best in the world. But most people at the Institute disliked him, finding him pompous and arrogant. I agree, Levine continued, that the fossil record is not helpful in addressing extinction, particularly if your thesis is that behavior is the cause of extinction, because bones don't tell us much about behavior. But I disagree that your behavioral thesis is untestable. In point of fact, it implies an outcome, although perhaps you haven't yet thought of it. The room was silent. At the podium, Malcolm frowned. The eminent mathematician was not accustomed to being told he had not thought through his ideas. "What's your point?" he said. Levine appeared indifferent to the tension in the room. "Just this," he said. "During the Cretaceous, dinosauria were widely distributed across the planet. We have found their remains on every continent and in every climatic zone, even in the Antarctic. Now, if their extinction was really the result of their behavior and not the consequence of a catastrophe or a disease or a change in plant life or any of the other broad-scale explanations that have been proposed, then it seems to me highly unlikely that they all changed their behavior at the same time, everywhere. And that, in turn, means that there may well be some remnants of these animals still alive on the Earth. Why couldn't you look for them?" "You could," Malcolm said coldly, "if that amused you. And if you had no more compelling use for your time." "No, no," Levine said earnestly. "I'm quite serious. What if the dinosaurs did not become extinct? What if they still exist, somewhere in an isolated spot on the planet?" "You're talking about a lost world," Malcolm said, and heads in the room nodded knowingly. Scientists at the Institute had developed a shorthand for referring to common evolutionary scenarios. They spoke of the field of bullets, the gambler's ruin, the game of life, the lost world, the red queen, and black noise. These were well-defined ways of thinking about evolution. But they were all... "No," Levine said stubbornly. "I am speaking literally." "Then you're badly deluded," Malcolm said, with a dismissive wave of his hand. He turned away from the audience and walked slowly to the blackboard. Now, if we consider the implications of the edge of chaos, we may begin by asking ourselves, what is the minimal unit of life? Most contemporary definitions of life would include the presence of DNA, but there are two examples which suggest to us that this definition is too narrow. If you consider viruses and so-called prions, it is clear that life may in fact exist without DNA. At the back of the room, Levine stared for a moment. Then, reluctantly, he sat down and began to make notes. The Lost World Hypothesis. The lecture ended, Malcolm hobbled across the open courtyard of the Institute shortly after noon. Walking beside him was Sarah Harding, a young field biologist visiting from Africa. Malcolm had known her for several years, since he had been asked to serve as an outside reader for her doctoral thesis at Berkeley. Crossing the courtyard in the hot summer sun, they made an unlikely pair. Malcolm dressed in black, stooped and ascetic, leaning on his cane. Harding, compact and muscular, looking young and energetic in shorts and a t-shirt. Her short black hair pushed up on her forehead with sunglasses. Her field of study was African predators, lions and hyenas. She was scheduled to return to Nairobi the next day. The two had been close since Malcolm's surgery. Harding had been on a sabbatical year in Austin and had helped nurse Malcolm back to health after his many operations. For a while it seemed as if a romance had blossomed and that Malcolm, a confirmed bachelor, would settle down. But then Harding had gone back to Africa and Malcolm had gone to Santa Fe. Whatever their former relationship had been, they were now just friends. They discussed the questions that had come at the end of his lecture. From Malcolm's point of view, there had been only the predictable objections. That mass extinctions were important. That human beings owed their existence to the Cretaceous extinction, which had wiped out the dinosaurs and allowed the mammals to take over. As one questioner had pompously phrased it, the Cretaceous allowed our own sentient awareness to arise on the planet. Malcolm's reply was immediate. What makes you think human beings are sentient and aware? There's no evidence for it. Human beings never think for themselves. They find it too uncomfortable. For the most part, members of our species simply repeat what they are told and become upset if they are exposed to any different view. The characteristic human trait is not awareness, but conformity, and the characteristic result is religious warfare. Other animals fight for territory or food, but uniquely in the animal kingdom, human beings fight for their beliefs. The reason is that beliefs guide behavior, which has evolutionary importance among human beings. But at a time when our behavior may well lead us to extinction, I see no reason to assume we have any awareness at all. We are stubborn, self-destructive conformists. Any other view of our species is just a self-congratulatory delusion. Next question. Now, walking across the courtyard, Sarah Harding laughed. They didn't care for that. I admit it's discouraging, he said, but it can't be helped. He shook his head. These are some of the best scientists in the country, and still, no interesting ideas. By the way, what's the story on that guy who interrupted me? Richard Levine? She laughed. Irritating, isn't he? He has a worldwide reputation for being a pain in the ass. Malcolm grunted. I'd say. He's wealthy is the problem, Harding said. You know about the Becky dolls? No, Malcolm said, giving her a glance. Well, every little girl in America does. There's a series. Becky and Sally and Frances and several more. They're Americana dolls. Levine is the heir of the company. So he's a smart-ass rich kid. Impetuous. Does whatever he wants. Malcolm nodded. You have time for lunch? Sure, I would be... Dr. Malcolm, Wait up. Please, Dr. Malcolm. Malcolm turned. Hurrying across the courtyard toward them was the gangling figure of Richard Levine. Ah, shit, Malcolm said. Dr. Malcolm, Levine said, coming up. I was surprised that you didn't take my proposal more seriously. How could I? Malcolm said. It's absurd. Yes, but Ms. Harding and I were just going to lunch, Malcolm said, gesturing to Sarah. Yes, but I think you should reconsider, Levine said, pressing on. Because I believe my argument is valid. It is entirely possible, even likely, that dinosaurs still exist. You must know there are persistent rumors about animals in Costa Rica, where I believe you have spent time. Yes, and in the case of Costa Rica, I can tell you, also in the Congo, Levine said, continuing. For years, there have been reports by pygmies of a large sauropod, perhaps even an apatosaur, in the dense forest around Bokambu. And also in the high jungles of Irian Jaya, there is supposedly an animal the size of a rhino, which perhaps is a remnant ceratopsian. Fantasy, Malcolm said. Pure fantasy. Nothing has ever been seen. No photographs. No hard evidence. Perhaps not, Levine said. But absence of proof is not proof of absence. I believe there may well be a locus of these animals. Survivals from a past time. Malcolm shrugged. Anything is possible, he said. But in point of fact, survival is possible, Levine insisted. I keep getting calls about new animals in Costa Rica. Remnants, fragments. Malcolm paused. Recently? Not for a while. Malcolm said. I thought so. The last call was 9 months ago, Levine said. I was in Siberia looking at that frozen baby mammoth and I couldn't get back in time. But I'm told it was some kind of very large, atypical lizard found dead in the jungle of Costa Rica. And? What happened to it? The remains were burned. So nothing is left? That's right. No photographs. No proof. Apparently not. So it's just a story, Malcolm said. Perhaps. But I believe it is worth mounting an expedition to find out about these reported survivals. Malcolm stared at him. An expedition? To find a hypothetical lost world? Who is going to pay for it? I am, Levine said. I have already begun the preliminary planning. But that could cost... I don't care what it costs, Levine said. The fact is, survival is possible. It has occurred in a variety of species from other genera, and it may be that there are survivals from the Cretaceous as well. Fantasy, Malcolm said again, shaking his head. Levine paused and stared at Malcolm. Dr. Malcolm, he said, I must say I'm very surprised at your attitude. You've just presented a thesis, and I am offering you a chance to prove it. I would have thought you'd jump at the opportunity. My jumping days are over, Malcolm said. But instead of taking me up on this, you... I'm not interested in dinosaurs, Malcolm said. But everyone is interested in dinosaurs. Not me. He turned on his cane and started to walk off. By the way, Levine said, what were you doing in Costa Rica? I heard you were there for almost a year. I was lying in a hospital bed. They couldn't move me out of intensive care for 6 months. I couldn't even get on a plane. Yes, Levine said, I know you got hurt. But what were you doing there in the first place? Weren't you looking for dinosaurs? Malcolm squinted at him in the bright sun and leaned on his cane. No, he said. I wasn't. They were all three sitting at a small painted table in the corner of the Guadalupe Café on the other side of the river. Sarah Harding drank Corona from the bottle and watched the two men opposite her. Levine looked pleased to be with them, as if he had won some victory to be sitting at the table. Malcolm looked weary, like a parent who has spent too much time with a hyperactive child.
"You want to know what I've heard?" Levine said. "I've heard that a couple of years back, a company named InGen genetically engineered some dinosaurs and put them on an island in Costa Rica. But something went wrong. A lot of people were killed and the dinosaurs were destroyed. And now nobody will talk about it because of some legal angle. Non-disclosure agreements or something. And the Costa Rican government doesn't want to hurt tourism. So nobody will talk. That's what I've heard."
Malcolm stared at him. "And you believe that?"
"Not at first I didn't," Levine said. "But the thing is, I keep hearing it. The rumors keep floating around. Supposedly you and Alan Grant and a bunch of other people were there."
"Did you ask Grant about it?"
"I asked him last year at a conference in Peking. He said it was absurd."
Malcolm nodded slowly.
"Is that what you say?" Levine asked, drinking his beer. "I mean, you know Grant, don't you?"
"No. I never met him."
Levine was watching Malcolm closely.
"So it's not true?"
Malcolm sighed. "Are you familiar with the concept of a techno-myth? It was developed by Geller at Princeton. Basic thesis is that we've lost all the old myths, Orpheus and Eurydice and Perseus and Medusa, so we fill the gap with modern techno-myths. Geller listed a dozen or so. One is that an alien's living at a hangar at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Another is that somebody invented a carburetor that gets 150 miles to the gallon, but the automobile companies bought the patent and are sitting on it. Then there's the story that the Russians trained children in ESP at a secret base in Siberia, and these kids can kill people anywhere in the world with their thoughts. The story that the lines in Nazca, Peru, are an alien spaceport. That the CIA released the AIDS virus to kill homosexuals. That Nikola Tesla discovered an incredible energy source, but his notes are lost. That in Istanbul, there's a 10th century drawing that shows the Earth from space. That the Stanford Research Institute found a guy whose body glows in the dark. Get the picture?
You're saying InGen's dinosaurs are a myth, Levine said.
Of course they are. They have to be. Do you think it's possible to genetically engineer a dinosaur?
The experts all tell me it's not.
And they're right, Malcolm said. He glanced at Harding as if for confirmation.
She said nothing, just drank her beer. In fact, Harding knew something more about these dinosaur rumors.
Once after surgery, Malcolm had been delirious, mumbling nonsense from the anesthesia and pain medication. And he had been seemingly fearful, twisting in the bed, repeating the names of several kinds of dinosaurs. Harding had asked the nurse about it. She said he was like that after every operation. The hospital staff assumed it was a drug-induced fantasy. Yet it seemed to Harding that Malcolm was reliving some terrifying actual experience. The feeling was heightened by the slangy, familiar way Malcolm referred to the dinosaurs. He called them raptors and compies and trikes, and he seemed especially fearful of the raptors. Later, when he was back home, she had asked him about his delirium. He had just shrugged it off, making a bad joke. "At least I didn't mention other women, did I?" And then he made some comment about having been a dinosaur nut as a kid and how illness made you regress. His whole attitude was elaborately indifferent, as if it were all unimportant. She had the distinct feeling he was being evasive. But she wasn't inclined to push it. Those were the days when she was in love with him, her attitude indulgent. Now he was looking at her in a questioning way, as if to ask if she was going to contradict him. Harding just raised an eyebrow and stared back. He must have his reasons. She could wait him out. Levine leaned forward across the table toward Malcolm and said, "So the InGen story is entirely untrue?" "Entirely untrue," Malcolm said, nodding gravely. "Entirely untrue." Malcolm had been denying the speculation for 3 years. By now he was getting good at it. His weariness was no longer affected, but genuine. In fact, he had been a consultant to International Genetic Technologies of Palo Alto in the summer of 1989, and he had made a trip to Costa Rica for them, which had turned out disastrously. In the aftermath, everyone involved had moved quickly to quash the story. InGen wanted to limit its liability. The Costa Rican government wanted to preserve its reputation as a tourist paradise. And the individual scientists had been bound by non-disclosure agreements, abetted later by generous grants to continue their silence. In Malcolm's case, 2 years of medical bills had been paid by the company. Meanwhile, InGen's island facility in Costa Rica had been destroyed. There were no longer any living creatures on the island. The company had hired the eminent Stanford professor George Baselton, a biologist and essayist whose frequent television appearances had made him a popular authority on scientific subjects. Baselton claimed to have visited the island and had been tireless in denying rumors that extinct animals had ever existed there. His derisive snort, "Saber-toothed tigers, indeed," was particularly effective. As time passed, interest in the story waned. InGen was long since bankrupt. The principal investors in Europe and Asia had taken their losses. Although the company's physical assets, the buildings and lab equipment, would be sold piecemeal, the core technology that had been developed would, they decided, never be sold. In short, the InGen chapter was closed. There was nothing more to say. "So there's no truth to it," Levine said, biting into his green corn tamale. "To tell you the truth, Dr. Malcolm, that makes me feel better." "Why?" Malcolm said. "Because it means that the remnants that keep turning up in Costa Rica must be real. Real dinosaurs. I've got a friend from Yale down there, a field biologist, and he says he's seen them." "I believe him." Malcolm shrugged. "I doubt," he said, "that any more animals will turn up in Costa Rica." "It's true there haven't been any for almost a year now. But if more show up, I'm going down there. And in the interim, I am going to outfit an expedition. I've been giving a lot of thought to how it should be done. I think the special vehicles could be built and ready in a year. I've already talked to Doc Thorne about it. Then I'll assemble a team, perhaps including Dr. Harding here, or a similarly accomplished naturalist, and some graduate students." Malcolm listened, shaking his head. "You think I'm wasting my time," Levine said.
"I do, yes.
But suppose, just suppose, that animals start to show up again."
"Never happen."
"But suppose they did," Levine said. "Would you be interested in helping me? To plan an expedition?" Malcolm finished his meal and pushed the plate aside. He stared at Levine. "Yes," he said finally. "If animals started showing up again, I would be interested in helping you."
"Great," Levine said. "That's all I wanted to know."
Outside, in the bright sunlight on Guadalupe Street, Malcolm walked with Sarah toward Malcolm's battered Ford sedan. Levine climbed into a bright red Ferrari, waved cheerfully, and roared off.
"You think it will ever happen?" Sarah Harding said. "That these
Animals will start showing up again?
No, Malcolm said. I am quite sure they never will.
You sound hopeful.
He shook his head and got awkwardly in the car, swinging his bad leg under the steering wheel. Harding climbed in beside him. He glanced at her and turned the key in the ignition. They drove back to the Institute. The following day, she went back to Africa. During the next 18 months, she had a rough sense of Levine's progress, since from time to time he called her with some question about field protocols, or vehicle tires, or the best anesthetic to use on animals in the wild. Sometimes she got a call from Doc Thorne, who was building the vehicles. He usually sounded harassed. From Malcolm, she heard nothing at all, although he sent her a card on her birthday. It arrived a month late. He had scrawled at the bottom, "Have a happy birthday. Be glad you're nowhere near him. He's driving me crazy." First configuration. In the conservative region far from the chaotic edge, individual elements coalesce slowly, showing no clear pattern. Ian Malcolm. Aberrant forms. In the fading afternoon light, the helicopter skimmed low along the coast, following the line where the dense jungle met the beach. The last of the fishing villages had flashed by beneath them 10 minutes ago. Now there was only impenetrable Costa Rican jungle, mangrove swamps, and mile after mile of deserted sand. Sitting beside the pilot, Marty Gutierrez stared out the window as the coastline swept past. There weren't even any roads in this area, at least none that Gutierrez could see. Gutierrez was a quiet, bearded American of 36, a field biologist who had lived for the last 8 years in Costa Rica. He had originally come to study toucan speciation in the rainforest, but stayed on as a consultant to the Reserva Biológica de Carrara, the national park in the north. He clicked the radio mic and said to the pilot, "How much farther?"
5 minutes, Senor Gutierrez.
Gutierrez turned and said,
"It won't be long now."
But the tall man folded up in the back seat of the helicopter didn't answer or even acknowledge that he had been spoken to. He merely sat with his hand on his chin and stared frowning out the window. Richard Levine wore sun-faded field khakis and an Australian slouch hat pushed low over his head. A battered pair of binoculars hung around his neck. But despite his rugged appearance, Levine conveyed an air of scholarly absorption. Behind his wire-frame spectacles, his features were sharp, his expression intense and critical as he looked out the window.
"What is this place?"
"It's called Rojas."
"So we're far south?"
"Yes, only about 50 miles from the border with Panama."
Levine stared at the jungle.
"I don't see any roads," he said. "How was the thing found?"
"Couple of campers," Gutierrez said. "They came in by boat, landed on the beach."
"When was that?"
"Yesterday. They took one look at the thing and ran like hell."
Levine nodded. With his long limbs folded up, his hands tucked under his chin, he looked like a praying mantis. That had been his nickname in graduate school. In part because of his appearance, and in part because of his tendency to bite off the head of anyone who disagreed with him. Gutierrez said,
"Been to Costa Rica before?"
"No." "First time," Levine said. And then he gave an irritable wave of his hand, as if he didn't want to be bothered with small talk. Gutierrez smiled. After all these years, Levine had not changed at all. He was still one of the most brilliant and irritating men in science. The two had been fellow graduate students at Yale until Levine quit the doctoral program to get his degree in comparative zoology instead. Levine announced he had no interest in the kind of contemporary field research that so attracted Gutierrez. With characteristic contempt, he had once described Gutierrez's work as collecting parrot crap from around the world.
The truth was that Levine, brilliant and fastidious, was drawn to the past, to the world that no longer existed. And he studied this world with obsessive intensity. He was famous for his photographic memory, his arrogance, his sharp tongue, and the unconcealed pleasure he took in pointing out the errors of colleagues. As a colleague once said, Levine never forgets a bone, and he never lets you forget it either. Field researchers disliked Levine, and he returned the sentiment. He was at heart a man of detail, a cataloger of animal life, and he was happiest poring over museum collections, reassigning species, rearranging display skeletons. He disliked the dust and inconvenience of life in the field. Given his choice, Levine would never leave the museum. But it was his fate to live in the greatest period of discovery in the history of paleontology. The number of known species of dinosaurs had doubled in the last 20 years, and new species were now being described at the rate of 1 every 7 weeks. Thus, Levine's worldwide reputation forced him to continually travel around the world, inspecting new finds and rendering his expert opinion to researchers who were annoyed to admit that they needed it.
"Where do you come from?" Gutierrez asked him.
"Mongolia," Levine said. "I was at the Flaming Cliffs in the Gobi Desert, 3 hours out of Ulaanbaatar."
"Oh? What's there?"
"John Roxton's got a dig. He found an incomplete skeleton he thought might be a new species of Velociraptor and wanted me to have a look."
"And?"
Levine shrugged. "Roxton never really did know anatomy. He's an enthusiastic fundraiser, but if he actually uncovers something, he's incompetent to proceed."
"You told him that?"
"Why not? It's the truth."
"And the skeleton?"
"The skeleton wasn't a raptor at all," Levine said. "Metatarsal is all wrong. Pubis too ventral. Ischium lacking a proper obturator. And the long bones much too light. As for the skull..." He rolled his eyes. "The palatal's too thick, and orbital fenestrae too rostral. Distal carina too small." "Oh, it goes on and on."
"And the trenchant unguals hardly present."
"So there we are. I don't know what Roxton could have been thinking. I suspect he actually has a subspecies of Troodon, though I haven't decided for sure."
"Troodon?" Gutierrez said.
"Small Cretaceous carnivore. 2 meters from pace to acetabulum. In point of fact, a rather ordinary theropod. And Roxton's find wasn't a particularly interesting example. Although there was one curious detail. The material included an integumental artifact, an imprint of the dinosaur's skin. That in itself is not rare. There are perhaps a dozen good skin impressions obtained so far, mostly among the Hadrosauridae. But nothing like this. Because it was clear to me that this animal's skin had some very unusual characteristics not previously suspected in dinosaurs."
"Señores," the pilot said, interrupting them, "Juan Fernandez Bay is ahead."
Levine said, "Circle it first, can we?" Levine looked out the window, his expression intense again, the conversation forgotten. They were flying over jungle that extended up into the hills for miles, as far as they could see. The helicopter banked, circling the beach.
"There it is now," Gutierrez said, pointing out the window.
The beach was a clean, curving white crescent, entirely deserted in the afternoon light. To the south, they saw a single dark mass in the sand. From the air, it looked like a rock, or perhaps a large clump of seaweed. The shape was amorphous, about 5 feet across. There were lots of footprints around it.
"Who's been here?" Levine said with a sigh. "Public health service people came out earlier today."
"Did they do anything?" he said.
"They touch it? Disturb it in any way?"
"I can't say," Gutierrez said.
"The public health service," Levine repeated, shaking his head. "What do they know?"
You should never have let them near it, Marty.
Hey, Gutierrez said, I don't run this country. I did the best I could. They wanted to destroy it before you even got here. At least I managed to keep it intact until you arrived. Although I don't know how long they'll wait.
Then we'd better get started, Levine said.
He pressed the button on his mic.
Why are we still circling? We're losing light. Get down on the beach now. I want to see this thing firsthand.
Richard Levine ran across the sand toward the dark shape, his binoculars bouncing on his chest. Even from a distance, he could smell the stench of decay. And already he was logging his preliminary impressions. The carcass lay half buried in the sand, surrounded by a thick cloud of flies. The skin was bloated with gas, which made identification difficult. He paused a few yards from the creature and took out his camera. Immediately, the pilot of the helicopter came up alongside him, pushing his hand down.
No permitido.
What?
I am sorry, señor. No pictures are allowed.
Why the hell not? Levine said. He turned to Gutierrez, who was trotting down the beach toward them.
Marty, why no pictures? This could be an important...
No pictures, the pilot said again, and he pulled the camera out of Levine's hand.
Marty, this is crazy.
Just go ahead and make your examination, Gutierrez said, and then he began speaking in Spanish to the pilot, who answered sharply and angrily, waving his hands.
Levine watched a moment, then turned away. The hell with this, he thought. They could argue forever. He hurried forward, breathing through his mouth. The odor became much stronger as he approached it. Although the carcass was large, he noticed there were no birds, rats, or other scavengers feeding on it. There were only flies. Flies so dense they covered the skin and obscured the outline of the dead animal. Even so, it was clear that this had been a substantial creature, roughly the size of a cow or horse before the bloat began to enlarge it further. The dry skin had cracked in the sun and was now peeling upward, exposing the layer of runny, yellow subdermal fat beneath.
Oof, it stunk. Levine winced. He forced himself closer, directing all his attention to the animal. Although it was the size of a cow, it was clearly not a mammal. The skin was hairless. The original skin color appeared to have been green, with a suggestion of darker striations running through it. The epidermal surface was pebbled in polygonal tubercles of varying sizes, the pattern reminiscent of the skin of a lizard. This texture varied in different parts of the animal, the pebbling larger and less distinct on the underbelly. There were prominent skin folds at the neck, shoulder, and hip joints, again like a lizard. But the carcass was large. Levine estimated the animal had originally weighed about 100 kilograms, roughly 220 pounds. No lizards grew that large anywhere in the world, except the Komodo dragons of Indonesia. Varanus komodoensis were 9-foot-long monitor lizards, crocodile-sized carnivores that ate goats and pigs, and, on occasion, human beings as well. But there were no monitor lizards anywhere in the New World. Of course, it was conceivable that this was one of the iguanidae. Iguanas were found all over South America, and the marine iguanas grew quite large. Even so, this would be a record-size animal. Levine moved slowly around the carcass toward the front of the animal. No, he thought, it wasn't a lizard. The carcass lay on its side, its left rib cage toward the sky. Nearly half of it was buried. The row of protuberances that marked the dorsal spinous processes of the backbone were just a few inches above the sand. The long neck was curved, the head hidden beneath the bulk of the body like a duck's head under feathers. Levine saw one forelimb which seemed small and weak. The distal appendage was buried in sand. He would dig that out and have a look at it, but he wanted to take pictures before he disturbed the specimen in situ.
In fact, the more Levine saw of this carcass, the more carefully he thought he should proceed. Because one thing was clear. This was a very rare and possibly unknown animal. Levine felt simultaneously excited and cautious. If this discovery was as significant as he was beginning to think it was, then it was essential that it be properly documented. Up the beach, Gutierrez was still shouting at the pilot, who kept shaking his head stubbornly. These Banana Republic bureaucrats, Levine thought. Why shouldn't he take pictures? It couldn't harm anything, and it was vital to document the changing state of the creature. He heard a thumping and looked up to see a second helicopter circling the bay, its dark shadow sliding across the sand. This helicopter was ambulance white with red lettering on the side. In the glare of the setting sun, he couldn't read it. He turned back to the carcass, noticing now that the hind leg of the animal was powerfully muscled, very different from the foreleg. It suggested that this creature walked upright, balanced on strong hind legs. Many lizards were known to stand upright, of course, but none so large as this. In point of fact, as Levine looked at the general shape of the carcass, he felt increasingly certain that this was not a lizard. He worked quickly now, for the light was fading and he had much to do. With every specimen, there was always two major questions to answer, both equally important. First, what was the animal? Second, why had it died? Standing by the thigh, he saw the epidermis was split open, no doubt from the gaseous subcutaneous buildup. But as Levine looked more closely, he saw that the split was in fact a sharp gash, and that it ran deep through the femorotibialis, exposing red muscle and pale bone beneath. He ignored the stench and the white maggots that wriggled across the open tissues of the gash, because he realized that...
"Sorry about all this," Gutierrez said, coming over, "but the pilot just refuses."
The pilot was nervously following Gutierrez, standing beside him, watching carefully.
"Marty," Levine said, "I really need to take pictures here." "I'm afraid you can't," Gutierrez said with a shrug. "It's important, Marty." "Sorry. I tried my best."
Farther down the beach, the white helicopter landed, its whine diminishing. Men in uniforms began getting out.
"Marty, what do you think this animal is?"
"Well, I can only guess," Gutierrez said. "From the general dimensions, I'd call it a previously unidentified iguana. It's extremely large, of course, and obviously not native to Costa Rica. My guess is this animal came from the Galapagos, or one of the..."
"No, Marty," Levine said. "It's not an iguana."
"Before you say anything more," Gutierrez said, glancing at the pilot, "I think you ought to know that several previously unknown species of lizard have shown up in this area. Nobody's quite sure why. Perhaps it's due to the cutting of the rainforest or some other reason. But new species are appearing. Several years ago, I began to see unidentified species of..."
"Marty, it's not a damn lizard."
Gutierrez blinked his eyes.
"What are you saying? Of course it's a lizard."
"I don't think so," Levine said.
Gutierrez said, "You're probably just thrown off because of its size. The fact is, here in Costa Rica, we occasionally encounter these aberrant forms."
"Marty," Levine said coldly, "I am never thrown off."
"Well, of course, I didn't mean that..."
"And I am telling you, this is not a lizard," Levine said.
"I'm sorry," Gutierrez said, shaking his head, "but I can't agree."
Back at the white helicopter, the men were huddled together, putting on white surgical masks.
"I'm not asking you to agree," Levine said.
He turned back to the carcass.
"The diagnosis is settled easily enough. All we need do is excavate the head, or for that matter, any of the limbs. For example, this thigh here, which I believe..."
He broke off and leaned closer. He peered at the back of the thigh.
"What is it?" Gutierrez said. "Give me your knife."
Why?
Gutierrez said.
Just give it to me.
Gutierrez fished out his pocket knife, put the handle in Levine's outstretched hand. Levine peered steadily at the carcass.
I think you will find this interesting.
What?
Right along the posterior dermal line, there is a...
Suddenly, they heard shouting on the beach and looked up to see the men from the white helicopter running down the beach toward them. They carried tanks on their backs and were shouting in Spanish.
What are they saying? Levine asked, frowning.
Gutierrez sighed.
They're saying to get back.
Tell them we're busy, Levine said, and bent over the carcass again. But the men kept shouting, and suddenly there was a roaring sound, and Levine looked up to see flamethrowers igniting, big red jets of flame roaring out in the evening light. He ran around the carcass toward the men, shouting, "No! No!" But the men paid no attention. He shouted, "No! This is a priceless..." The first of the uniformed men grabbed Levine and threw him roughly to the sand.
What the hell are you doing?
Levine yelled, scrambling to his feet. But even as he said it, he saw it was too late. The first of the flames had reached the carcass, blackening the skin, igniting the pockets of methane with a blue whoomp. The smoke from the carcass began to rise thickly into the sky.
Stop it! Stop it!
Levine turned to Gutierrez.
Make them stop it!
But Gutierrez was not moving. He was staring at the carcass. Consumed by flames, the torso crackled and the fat sputtered, and then as the skin burned away, the black, flat ribs of the skeleton were revealed, and then the whole torso turned, and suddenly the neck of the animal swung up, surrounded by flames, moving as the skin contracted. And inside the flames, Levine saw a long, pointed snout and rows of sharp, predatory teeth and hollow eye sockets, the whole thing burning like some medieval dragon rising in flames up into the sky.
San Jose. Levine sat in the bar of the San Jose airport, nursing a beer, waiting for his plane back to the States. Gutierrez sat beside him at a small table, not saying much. An awkward silence had fallen for the last few minutes. Gutierrez stared at Levine's backpack on the floor by his feet. It was specially constructed of dark green Gore-Tex, with extra pockets on the outside for all the electronic gear.
Pretty nice pack, Gutierrez said. Where'd you get that, anyway?
Looks like a thorn pack.
Levine sipped his beer.
It is.
Nice, Gutierrez said, looking at it.
What have you got there in the top flap? A satellite phone? And a GPS? Boy, what they won't think of next. Pretty slick. Must have cost you a...
Marty, Levine said in an exasperated tone.
Cut the crap. Are you going to tell me or not?
Tell you what? I want to know what the hell's going on here.
Richard, look, I'm sorry if you...
No, Levine said, cutting him off. That was a very important specimen on that beach, Marty, and it was destroyed. I don't understand why you let it happen. Gutierrez sighed. He looked around at the tourists at the other tables and said,
This has to be in confidence, okay?
All right.
It's a big problem here.
What is?
There have been, aberrant forms turning up on the coast every so often. It's been going on for several years now.
Aberrant forms? Levine repeated, shaking his head in disbelief.
That's the official term for these specimens, Gutierrez said. No one in the government is willing to be more precise. It started about 5 years ago. A number of animals were discovered up in the mountains, near a remote agricultural station that was growing test varieties of soybeans.
Soybeans, Levine repeated. Gutierrez nodded.
Apparently, these animals are attracted to beans and certain grasses. The assumption is that they have a great need for the amino acid lysine in their diets. But nobody is really sure. Perhaps they just have a taste for certain crops.
Marty, Levine said, I don't care if they have a taste for beer and pretzels. The only important question is, where did the animals come from?
Nobody knows, Gutierrez said. Levine let that pass for the moment. What happened to those other animals?
They were all destroyed.
And to my knowledge, no others were found for years afterward.
But now it seems to be starting again. In the last year, we have found the remains of 4 more animals, including the one you saw today.
And what was done?
The aberrant forms are always destroyed, just as you saw.
From the beginning, the government's taken every possible step to make sure nobody finds out about it. A few years back, some North American journalists began reporting there was something wrong on one island, Isla Nublar. Menendez invited a bunch of journalists down for a special tour of the island and proceeded to fly them to the wrong island. They never knew the difference. Stuff like that. I mean, the government's very serious about this.
Why?
They're worried.
Worried?
Why should they be worried about... Gutierrez held up his hand, shifted in his chair, moved closer.
Disease, Richard.
Disease?
Yeah. Costa Rica has one of the best healthcare systems in the world, Gutierrez said.
The epidemiologists have been tracking some weird type of encephalitis that seems to be on the increase, particularly along the coast.
Encephalitis? Of what origin? Viral?
Gutierrez shook his head.
No causative agent has been found.
Marty.
I'm telling you, Richard. Nobody knows.
It's not a virus, because antibody titers don't go up and white cell differentials don't change.
It's not bacterial, because nothing has ever been cultured. It's a complete mystery.
All the epidemiologists know is that it seems to affect primarily rural farmers, people who are around animals and livestock. And it's a true encephalitis. Splitting headaches, mental confusion, fever, delirium.
Mortality?
So far it seems to be self-limited. Lasts about 3 weeks. But even so, it's got the government worried. This country is dependent on tourism, Richard. Nobody wants talk of unknown diseases.
So they think the encephalitis is related to these aberrant forms?
He shrugged.
Lizards carry lots of viral diseases, Gutierrez said. They're a known vector. So it's not unreasonable there might be a connection.
But you said this isn't a viral disease.
Whatever it is, they think it's related.
Levine said, all the more reason to find out where these lizards are coming from.
Surely they must have searched.
Searched, Gutierrez said with a laugh.
Of course they've searched. They've gone over every square inch of this country again and again. They've sent out dozens of search parties. I've led several myself. They've done aerial surveys. They've had overflights of the jungle. They've had overflights of the offshore islands. That in itself is a big job. There are quite a few islands, you know, particularly along the west coast. Hell, they've even searched the ones that are privately owned.
Are there privately owned islands? Levine asked.
A few. 3 or 4. Like Isla Nublar. It was leased to an American company, InGen, for years.
But you said that island was searched.
Thoroughly searched. Nothing there.
And the others?
Well, let's see, Gutierrez said, ticking them off on his fingers.
There's Isla Talamanca on the east coast. They've got a Club Med there. There's Sorna on the west coast. It's leased to a German mining company. And there's Morazan up north. It's actually owned by a wealthy Costa Rican family. And there may be another island I've forgotten about.
And the searches found what?
Nothing, Gutierrez said. They've found nothing at all.
So the assumption is that the animals are coming from some location deep in the jungle. And that's why we haven't been able to find it so far.
Levine grunted.
In that case, lots of luck.
I know, Gutierrez said. Rainforest is an incredibly good environment for concealment. A search party could pass within 10 yards of a large animal and never see it. And even the most advanced remote sensing technology doesn't help much because there are multiple layers to penetrate. Clouds, tree canopy, lower-level flora. There's just no way around it. Almost anything could be hiding in the rainforest.
Anyway, he said, the government's frustrated. And, of course, the government is not the only interested party.
Levine looked up sharply.
Oh?
Yes.
For some reason, there's been a lot of interest in these animals.
What sort of interest? Levine said, as casually as he could.
Last fall, the government issued a permit to a team of botanists from Berkeley to do an aerial survey of the jungle canopy in the Central Highlands. The survey had been going on for a month when a dispute arose. A bill for aviation fuel or something like that. Anyway, a bureaucrat in San Jose called Berkeley to complain. And Berkeley said they'd never heard of this survey team. Meantime, the team fled the country.
So nobody knows who they really were.
No.
Then last winter, a couple of Swiss geologists showed up to collect gas samples from offshore islands as part of a study, they said, of volcanic activity in Central America. The offshore islands are all volcanic, and most of them are still active to some degree, so it seemed like a reasonable request. But it turned out the geologists really worked for an American genetics company called Biosyn, and they were looking for, large animals on the islands.
Why would a biotech company be interested? Levine said. It makes no sense.
Maybe not to you and me, Gutierrez said. But Biosyn's got a particularly unsavory reputation. Their head of research is a guy named Lewis Dodgson.
Oh, yeah, Levine said. I know.
He's the guy who ran that rabies vaccine test in Chile a few years back. The one where they exposed farmers to rabies but didn't tell them they were doing it.
That's him.
He also started test marketing a genetically engineered potato in supermarkets without telling anybody they were altered. Gave kids low-grade diarrhea. Couple of them ended up in the hospital. After that, the company had to hire George Basilton to fix their image.
Seems like everybody hires Basilton, Levine said.
Gutierrez shrugged.
The big-name university professors consult these days. It's part of the deal.
And Basilton is Regis Professor of Biology. The company needed him to clean up their mess because Dodgson has a habit of breaking the law. Dodgson has people on his payroll all around the world. Steals other companies' research, the whole bit. They say Biosyn's the only genetics company with more lawyers than scientists.
And why were they interested in Costa Rica? Levine asked.
Gutierrez shrugged.
I don't know.
But the whole attitude toward research has changed, Richard. It's very noticeable here. Costa Rica has one of the richest ecologies in the world. 500,000 species in 12 distinct environmental habitats. 5% of all the species on the planet are represented here. This country has been a biological research center for years, and I can tell you, things have changed. In the old days, the people who came here were dedicated scientists with a passion to learn about something for its own sake. Howler monkeys, or Palestine wasps, or the sombrilla plant. These people had chosen their field because they cared about it. They certainly weren't going to get rich. But now,
everything in the biosphere is potentially valuable. Nobody knows where the next drug is coming from, so drug companies fund all sorts of research. Maybe a bird egg has a protein that makes it waterproof. Maybe a spider produces a peptide that inhibits blood clotting. Maybe the waxy surface of a fern contains a painkiller. It happens often enough that attitudes toward research have changed. People aren't studying the natural world anymore. They're mining it. It's a looter mentality. Anything new or unknown is automatically of interest because it might have value. It might be worth a fortune. Gutierrez drained his beer. The world, he said, is turned upside down. And the fact is that a lot of people want to know what these aberrant animals represent and where they come from. The loudspeaker called Levine's flight. Both men stood up from the table. Gutierrez said, "You'll keep all this to yourself? I mean, what you saw today." "To be quite honest," Levine said, "I don't know what I saw today. It could have been anything." Gutierrez grinned. "Safe flight, Richard. Take care, Marty."
End of Disc 1. Disc 2. Departure. His backpack slung over his shoulder, Levine walked toward the departure lounge. He turned to wave goodbye to Gutierrez, but his friend was already heading out the door, raising his arm to wave for a taxi. Levine shrugged, turned back. Directly ahead was the customs desk. Travelers lined up to have their passports stamped. He was booked on a night flight to San Francisco, with a long stopover in Mexico City. Not many people were queuing up. He probably had time to call his office and leave word for his secretary, Linda, that he would be on the flight. And perhaps, he thought, he should also call Malcolm. Looking around, he saw a row of phones marked ICT Telefonos International along the wall to his right, but there were only a few and all were in use. He had better use the satellite phone in his backpack, he thought, as he swung the pack off his shoulder, and perhaps it would be... He paused, frowning. He looked back at the wall. Four people were using the phones. The first was a blonde woman in shorts and a halter top, bouncing a young sunburned child in her arms as she talked. Next to her stood a bearded man in a safari jacket who glanced repeatedly at his gold Rolex watch. Then there was a gray-haired, grandmotherly woman talking in Spanish while her two full-grown sons stood by, nodding emphatically. And the last person was the helicopter pilot. He had removed his uniform jacket and was standing in short sleeves and tie. He was turned away, facing the wall, shoulders hunched. Levine moved closer and heard the pilot speaking in English. Levine set his pack down and bent over it, pretending to adjust the straps while he listened. The pilot was still turned away from him. He heard the pilot say, "No, no, Professor. It is not that way. No." Then there was a pause. "No," the pilot said. "I am telling to you, no. I am sorry, Professor Basildon, but this is not known. It is an island, but which one... We must wait again for more. No, he leaves tonight. No, I think he does not know anything. And no pictures. No. I understand. Adios." Levine ducked his head as the pilot walked briskly toward the LACSA desk at the other end of the airport.
What the hell? He thought. It is an island, but which one? How did they know it was an island?
Levine himself was still not sure of that. And he had been working intensively on these finds, day and night, trying to put it together. Where they had come from. Why it was happening. He walked around the corner, out of sight, and pulled out the little satellite phone. He dialed it quickly, calling a number in San Francisco. The call went through, rapidly clicking as it linked with the satellite. It began to ring. There was a beep. An electronic voice said, "Please enter your access code." Levine punched in a 6-digit number. There was another beep. The electronic voice said, "Leave your message." "I'm calling," Levine said, "with the results of the trip." Single specimen, not in good shape. Location BB-17 on your map. That's far south, which fits all of our hypotheses. I wasn't able to make a precise identification before they burned the specimen. But my guess is that it was an ornitholestes. As you know, this animal is not on the list. A highly significant finding. He glanced around, but no one was near him. No one was paying attention. Furthermore, the lateral femur was cut in a deep gash. "This is extremely disturbing." He hesitated, not wanting to say too much. "And I am sending back a sample that requires close examination. I also think some other people are interested. Anyway, whatever is going on down here is new, Ian. There haven't been any specimens for over a year, and now they're showing up again. Something new is happening, and we don't understand it at all." Or do we? Levine thought. He pressed the disconnect, turned the phone off, and replaced it in the outer pocket of his backpack. Maybe, he thought, we know more than we realize. He looked thoughtfully toward the departure gate. It was time to catch his flight.